This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, a deal was made for the government to buy the Headwaters Redwood Forest in California, but it may fall through if conditions aren't met. Actor Todd Moore takes us into the heart of the dispute over the ancient forest in the Pacific Northwest and into the hearts of the people who live there. A portrait of a desert oasis in Utah. And in the Earth calendar, 10,000 wildebeest eat up front yards in Nairobi, Kenya. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Last September, an unusual agreement was signed by the governments of the U.S. and California, a senator and congressman from California, the Pacific Lumber Company, and its parent, the Maxim Corporation. The agreement was designed to provide for the protection of the Headwaters Forest in California, which is part of the largest block of redwoods left in private ownership. Maxim and Pacific Lumber agreed to sell 3,000 acres of the Headwaters Forest and 400 acres of the Elkhead Springs Forest. They would also provide certain buffering lands. The U.S. government will put up $250 million, and California will pay $130 million. The deal will only go through, however, if the government and Pacific Lumber can agree on plans to manage the remaining 200,000 acres Pacific owns. The plans would limit lumbering and protect endangered species, like the marbled murrelet. That's a small seabird that nests in the ancient forest and whose population has been declining at over 4% a year. At one point, Pacific Lumber said it would log all old-growth redwood that was not on land sold to the government, action which environmentalists say would wipe out the marble murrelet. Putting together both the management plans and the financial package is proving to be extremely difficult, and the outcome is by no means assured. John Garamendi, Deputy Secretary for the U.S. Department of the Interior, heads up the effort for the federal government.
It's a very complex, difficult negotiation. The Habitat Conservation Plan, which covers some 200,000 acres, must be based on science and designed in such a way as to protect all of the endangered and potentially endangered species in the area. And that's also coupled with a sustained yield plan for the state of California that would, those two things together would determine how that forest would be managed in the future. A very complex, scientifically, biologically complex process and fraught with very tough negotiating out ahead of us between the scientists and Pacific Lumber Company. So.
Also difficult is putting the money together to pay Maxim. Currently, the government is proposing to give Maxim certain oil and gas leases near Bakersville and some commercial real estate. Joel Ratner, president of the Rose Foundation for Communities and the Environment, a nonprofit group in Oakland, thinks there's a better way to pay Maxim. She calls it a debt for nature swap.
Well, right now there are three cases pending against Maxim, which you know is the parent of Pacific Lumber, against Mr. Charles Hurwitz, who is the CEO and president of Maxim Corporation. The three cases that are pending all relate to the failure of a savings and loan in Texas in 1988. That savings and loan was one that Maxim had a very substantial business interest in and allegedly controlled. What folks have been suggesting for some time is that it would make a lot of sense for the government agencies and Maxim and Mr. Hurwitz to settle these cases by surrendering, or to settle the cases by turning over portions of Headwaters Forest to the federal government. And in exchange for that, the government would drop the financial aspects of those claims.
While the debt for nature idea sounds good to environmentalists, Pacific Lumber, which was not available to be interviewed, states on its webpage that there is no savings and loan debt to the government. Deputy Secretary Garamondi also rejects the idea of linking the savings and loan claims against Maxim and Hurwitz with the Headwaters Agreement.
There is no linkage. Let me put it that way, just very bluntly. There is no linkage. We cannot legally proceed from our from what we're attempting to do and link that to the FDIC OTS lawsuits. To do so is flat out illegal, and we're not doing it. Now, if there is something there, then there's something there, and that'll have to be on a different track. I think the environmental community and those who advocate that are taking a very risky path. They're assuming that there is value there and that it can be somehow negotiated for the Redwoods. Well, there may or may not be any value there. There may or may not be a successful lawsuit by the government. It certainly has not even gone to court yet, let alone into a jury. So to pin all of our hopes on that is, in my view, a very risky strategy and one that, frankly, we've rejected and are proceeding on the track that we are presently on, that of trying to engage in a swap to obtain the forest and at the same time protect the remaining 200,000 acres with a habitat conservation plan and a sustained yield plan.
As an advocate for the protection of the entire forest, Joel Ratner and the Rose Foundation is also pursuing other strategies to influence Maxim. She says public pension plans in California, Ohio, and Colorado, and the California State Teachers Retirement System all own stock in the Maxim Corporation. She wants pension plan members and other shareholders to put pressure on Maxim at its coming annual meeting.
I am a Maxim shareholder, and together with the As You Sow Foundation and with another officer of the Rose Foundation, who's also a Maxim shareholder, we are sponsoring a resolution that will be voted on at the May shareholder meeting calling on Maxim to become a willing seller of all 60,000 acres of headwaters and to pursue debt for nature as one possible form of consideration for part of the property. We're also sponsoring a slate of independent directors who we believe could bring an important outside voice to the board.
In May, the plan for habitat conservation on the Pacific lands is due to be released by the government scientists and the negotiating team. If it's accepted by Maxim, the 10-year struggle to protect the headwaters may be winding down, provided the money can be found. If Maxim finds it's too restrictive and will not agree, the struggle continues, and the already numerous lawsuits challenging the lumbering operations will continue. I'm Peter Burley. Battles over the last of the ancient forests in the Northwest evoke strong emotions, perhaps because the virgin trees are backed up against the Pacific Ocean, and once they're gone, the process of felling them, which American settlers pursued relentlessly as they marched westward across our continent, is over. But the battles involve more than trees, endangered birds, and fish. There are people. They're as sturdy as the trees themselves, and a rich culture has evolved which embraces both the trees and the struggle to save them. Actor and author Todd Jefferson Moore has written a play called In the Heart of the Wood. It's based on his interviews with environmentalists, loggers, and mill operators. He performs each of the characters himself, and first we hear him as Larry, the ex-timber mill owner from Forks, Washington.
The Earth First organization had a campout, which was a protest to get one of these dams removed. So I and a couple of my logger buddies decide to go out there and see what these eco-terrorists look like. So we go out there, and you have to hike in a couple miles to get to where the campground is. The Park Service is there. They got security 24 hours around these kids. There's a hot spring there, you know, primitive hot spring. So, I mean, these kids are up there in this campground, and we hike up, and I mean, you know, they're bizarre in appearance. So they come up, and they're all 18 years old, you know, young kids. So I start to talk to them, and I'm standing in this campground in a grove of Douglas fir trees. And I said, you know, we'd just like to talk to you a little bit, see where you're coming from. Do you know what we're standing in right now? And they said, well, this is the ancient forest. And I said, well, what do you mean by ancient? And they said, oh, thousands of years old. So I said, well, 200 years ago, this forest we're standing in burned to a crisp. And I can tell that by the size of the trees, but also because I know that Douglas fir doesn't regenerate except when there's a forest fire intense enough to take out any shade creation, because Douglas fir is not shade tolerant. Oh no, this is the ancient forest. There's never been any forest fire here. So I said, look, you go out and you find the biggest, oldest tree around. You dig down around the roots and you will find that they are black and burned. And they did. And it was. And then we're off. We're talking about the forest. You know why there's this little one here and why that one's bigger over there and what the construction of the forest is. And none of them had a clue. I mean, what I found out, and we had like 40 of them, you know, in a circle. I'm in the middle, and we're talking about the forest. You know, we're not talking about political issues, Elwha dams, any of that. What I found out was that 80% of them were nice kids. I mean, nice kids. That at that moment in their life when they needed something to grab hold of, this is what presented itself. I mean, they were sincere, dedicated, impassioned, nice kids that had gotten launched off on this sideways track the way kids have always done. And then there were about 20% of them that were sickos. I mean, when the woman started talking about how every day she's got to struggle with whether or not to commit suicide, and, you know, that kind of thing, because her presence on the planet is detrimental to whatever. So I said, well, why don't you do us a favor and get it over with? I mean, you know, don't cry about it. Make up your mind. Either live and contribute or die and get out of the way. But you see, the sick ones were leaders. And this gets back to Windsos. Because here we are, us three loggers, sitting, having a good conversation for 3 or 4 hours with these kids, sharing information, experiences, and developing a certain amount of better feelings about one another than we had before. But if this had been in the middle of the night, and one of those earth firsters was led by one of those sickos, and they were out pouring sand down the fuel tank of a piece of my equipment, they'd be dead. Because at that moment, there is no room for discussion.
Author Todd Jefferson Moore next introduces us to Daryl, an unemployed logger who loves tree cutting for the macho experience that it is.
I've been buried alive by a tree. It uprooted up the hill above me. Had my leg broke, my back broke, my hip broke, my jaw broke. Yeah, my hands don't work so well anymore because of the white finger. Nerve damage, circulation damage. But I'll tell you, there's no drug like it. Logging hasn't been made yet. It's a definite high. I mean, you're out there in this razorback ridge. I mean, a rock ridge. And there's a tree out there maybe 20 feet out on it, growing out on this rock knob. And you got to walk with your feet like this just to stay on top of it. And, I mean, it's not a very far fall, maybe 60 to 80 feet before you hit the first time. And you got to go out there and fall this tree because the skyline's going to slag into it, and they can't log around it, so you got to cut it. And you're just hoping that the damn thing is solid at the stump and it's not rotten because you can't run. You just got to sit there and take it. Thing of it is, there's no such thing as can't out there. You can't say, well, I can't do it. You find a way no matter what. You wouldn't ride home on the crew bus. They'd run you out of the woods.
Moore's final sketch is of Henry, a millworker retrainee at Gray's Harbor, who reflects on life after logging jobs in the woods come to an end.
I worked for 30 years before I ever drew my first dollar of unemployment. Anyway, I had a lot to say about those people on unemployment and welfare and food stamps and that. And I guess the Lord got tired of hearing me and adjusted my attitude a little bit. With all of that, Well, I think that's what caused my high blood pressure and, a lot of depression and just thinking about being on welfare. And we had just gotten the food stamps, and I had some, and I went to the shopper market. It was in the morning. Must have been about 7 in the morning. And I went in there, and there was a friend of mine in there, you know, someone I knew from church. And he and I, well, I guess we used to brag to each other about what good workers we were, how we always had a good job and a good income and that. And I just remember lollygagging around the back of that store till I made sure he had left before I went to that cash register with those food stamps. But I'm going to be all right now, and I'm going to be able to support my family. And I'm sure going to be glad to go into a store again and spend cash. But I have a whole different attitude about those people that need help. Whole different attitude.
We have been listening to Todd Jefferson Moore reading from his one-man play, In the Heart of the Woods, in which he portrays the people who work in the forests of the Northwest. The Environment Show wants to hear from you. On future shows, we'll be talking about what to do with the nation's chemical weapons. We'll also answer your questions about the environment. Once before, I said if we couldn't find an answer, we'd make one up. As a listener complained about my attempt at humor, I won't crack that joke again. But join us by calling our toll-free number. It's 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You can visit us on the internet, where you can hear the Environment Show anytime. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Bruce Berger is author of The Telling Distance, Conversations with the American Desert, published by the University of Arizona Press. He presents a portrait of a rare, fertile patch of land in Utah. He spoke to us from La Paz, Mexico, where he's working on a new book.
Lying one day's drive from the Escalante River, the Maze, and several other prime locations, the Wash was for years a convenient overnight car camp. A string of cottonwoods, spaced like bad teeth, formed a quarter-mile crescent through which a stream bed wound back and forth, frosted with alkali. Across the western horizon spread the crimson and taffy spires, domes, upheavals, and twists of a fault called the San Rafael Swell, and to the south sat a rock like a vermilion temple. At either end, the Wash trailed into barrenness, lost among low hills. Offering the only foliage for miles around, scattered with the tracks, hoofprints, and tire treads of creatures never seen, with a few birds phrasing the silence and the sense of an arthritic hand exhausted from squeezing the sky, this way station haunted me long after our glamorous destinations. Recent migrations had led me elsewhere. I hadn't been back for a half dozen years, and I had almost forgotten the turnoff. But as soon as we rounded the crest and I saw the mangy trees still rattling their green, my heart began to pound. It was nearing sundown, and the San Rafael Swell strode forward, deep-shadowed and incandescent. My friends grabbed their cooking equipment and sleeping bags. I grabbed a beer from the cooler and wandered off for a private reunion. The very grains of alkali seemed unchanged. As I reached the bend, 5 barn owls wheeled just overhead, pale and silent, each disc-like face peering for an instant into mine with small black eyes. A single pool mirrored the great rock turning slowly to blood. Insects sounded the bass note of being. I inspected the wash later by flashlight, and again, coffee cup in hand, the next morning. Then, as usual, we were off. Someday the wash will be my destination. I will stay a few days. I will hike the stream bed in both directions and discover what it does in the low hills. I will sit with binoculars and patience, deciphering the animals, learning the birds. I will feel the extremes of temperature, the range of light. Or maybe I will always touch and go, leaving the wash half dreamt with its scraggy trees, its shadows of hoofs, scales, and claws, its singing finches and bees, its single pools, the vortex of desolation, and center of one person's universe.
Bruce Berger, reading from his book, The Telling Distance, Conversations with the American Desert, published by University of Arizona Press. We caught up with him in La Paz, Mexico. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. Every year at this time, residents of Nairobi, Kenya, are caught in the middle of a massive migration of animals. They move in accordance with rainfall patterns with a change in the spring and fall. Dr. Helen Gachoe is the director of the African Conservation Center in Nairobi. She says many of the animals migrate through the Nairobi National Park, which is only a few miles from the city center.
We have about 25,000 and 30,000 animals moving. And in the Nairobi Park, the animals are avoiding housing. They're avoiding fences. They're crossing roads, major roads. It kind of makes it more interesting to see animals, you know, kind of able to do these things and get on with their movements and get on with their lives despite the kind of many disruptions in their path.
Dr. Gachoe says that migrating animals around Nairobi include wildebeest, zebra, and antelope. Of course, following along with them are predators like lions and cheetahs. If a zebra gets loose in town, that's one thing, but a lion is something different. That's why the Nairobi National Park is surrounded by fencing to keep the humans and animals away from each other.
Around the park itself, there's a lot of housing development and industrial development. So on the northern, western, and eastern sides of the park, there is a fence. It would be very dangerous if that was open, because you would have animals wandering into the city, and we have quite a high population of predators in the park, and that would obviously be a real danger to people working in those areas that are close next to the park.
Like many other major cities, Nairobi is experiencing explosive growth. When the Nairobi National Park was created in 1946, the city was small, and animals and people kept to themselves. But as the city grew, conflicts arose. Dr. Gachoe says giraffes were a constant menace on the runways of the airport till they erected fences. But since most of the city's growth is occurring on the outskirts of town, the situation has only gotten worse. She's working on protecting land and creating corridors for wildlife to migrate, but she says as roads and houses are built, conflicts are inevitable.
Every now and then, you will have a lion wandering off to outside of the park, crossing the river. You know, you have sometimes have people, dogs eaten right out their doorstep by lion, by leopard. People are complaining about 10,000 wildebeest descending on their property one fine morning on their way, either on their way to Nairobi Park or on their way out. And by the time they leave, sometimes every blade of grass will be gone.
While springtime in Nairobi is signified by a mass migration of animals, in this country, spring is signified by the sound of lawnmowers. If all that mowing gets you down, Pack the family up and head to Nairobi, where 10,000 wildebeest will solve that pesky lawn mowing problem once and for all. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, many of the fish which anglers love come from hatcheries which cost taxpayers million and may be hurting the environment. We talk green about ecotourism. Is it good for the environment, or is it simply a greenwashed way to take your money? We look at the Black Hills of South Dakota, then and now, and a 150-year-old folk song takes us lumbering in the Adirondacks of New York. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Anglers know that many of the fish they catch wouldn't be there if it weren't for fish hatcheries. Hundreds of these facilities operate from coast to coast for the sole purpose of providing fish for sportsmen and sportswomen. But a growing number of scientists and environmentalists are beginning to question whether fish hatcheries make any economic or environmental sense. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
Sport fishing is big business. In Colorado, for instance, it brings in $950 million a year. So the state places a high priority on keeping anglers happy.
In some years, we've raised as many as 5 million catchable trout and up to 18 million subcatchable. That's in addition to many millions of small to fairly good-sized warm water species such as catfish, northern pike, a number of other species. But our primary emphasis has always been on trout because Colorado is one of the state's premier trout fishing meccas. When people come to Colorado and see the high Rockies, they think of skiing. They think of a number of different things. But one of the things they think about is wildlife, especially catching rainbow trout.
But those trout are exotic and wouldn't be there if it weren't for fish hatcheries. Todd Malmesbury is with the Colorado Division of Wildlife. He says much of his state's fishing industry relies on hatcheries. While some scientists say hatcheries cause a host of environmental problems, Malmesbury says the environmental risk is worth it because it's either hatcheries or no fish.
The West is dam country. There's a lot of dams on the big western rivers. What we have to do in those situations is provide fishing recreation based on that artificial habitat. That means that we have big, deep reservoirs or lakes that would not normally be there, and we're going to go ahead and use exotic trout species such as lake trout or rainbow trout in those situations. But wherever there's a possibility of restoring native cutthroat populations, that's our top priority, and we'll even go to the extreme of killing all the other exotic fish in a stream, making sure that they're gone, and then restoring native populations. In the West, where so many dams have been built, those options have been limited, and where the dams and reservoirs exist, we are going to continue to use exotic fish so that we can provide fishing recreation for the public.
But critics of hatcheries say they are responsible for spreading disease among fish, cause inbreeding, and all those fish crammed in together pollute the water with their waste. Meanwhile, the federal government spends $37 million a year to run 65 hatcheries nationwide, and that doesn't include the thousands of state-run and private hatcheries. John Epifanio is a conservation biologist with Trout Unlimited. He says the nation's fish and anglers would be better served if money were shifted away from hatcheries and spent on protecting fish habitat.
I think we're out of balance at this point.
we're spending a lot more on the technological solutions than getting back to the basics and fundamentals of protecting quality habitats and making sure we're not taking more than a system can produce. It will be a mistake if we think that we can, through these technological, solely relying on hatcheries or artificial propagation as a technological tool, that it alone can rectify some of the problems that have been created or compensate for those problems. Without attending to the habitat issues, the larger ecosystem issues, it cannot by itself compensate for those problems.
But fixing some habitat is impossible. When rivers are dammed, much of the ecosystem around the dam is killed. Building another ecosystem takes time and often requires the introduction of alien species, which can pose problems to native species. Exotic fish introduced decades ago still cause problems today. They were introduced to habitats without much thought to their impact. Around the turn of the century, so-called fish cars were built specifically to carry fish in tanks along rail lines so they could be dispersed throughout the nation's rivers and lakes. The idea was to increase the amount of fish for food as well as for sports fishermen. But in many instances, these efforts and other factors, such as overfishing and pollution, have led to the permanent reliance on hatcheries to keep some fish populations at the numbers required to meet the demand of fishermen. Gary Edwards is the Assistant Director of Fisheries for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He explains that his agency is responsible for providing fish for many rivers and lakes in the country.
But about 47% of our production is associated mainly producing rainbow trout for mitigation, and that means where, for example, down along the Red and White River in Arkansas, where dams went in, took what then was primarily a smallmouth fishery, basically eliminated that and created these very cold tailwater fisheries. We raise and assist through these mitigation projects of stocking rainbow trout in there to replace the losses. Without that production and without that stocking, there would be no fishing in there. The likelihood of those dams in that part of the country ever being removed to restore those systems back to where they were historically certainly will not happen in our collective lifetimes. So in that case, most of our trout production is associated with mitigation in habitats that have been probably altered and lost forever. The next largest component of our production is for Pacific salmonids, which makes up about 41% of it. The focus on there is to try to help and assist with restoring those historical runs, primarily out west in the Columbia, in the Snake River, and in the Sacramento. If we could go back in and replace that habitat, take out those dams, and get those runs coming back to their own, certainly we could help discontinue part of that program. But some of that habitat will probably be, spawning habitat will be lost forever. And without the use of hatcheries as a tool, then we're going to have to be willing to accept a lot less numbers of fish available for to meet both recreational, commercial, and tribal needs.
Today, about 2% of money spent on federal hatcheries is devoted to helping 26 threatened and endangered species recover. Many environmentalists applaud these efforts, which are credited for saving populations of striped bass, lake trout, and several other species, which may have disappeared if not for hatcheries. But the majority of hatcheries work to provide species valued more by fishermen than the environment. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about ecotourism, and we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. And our guests are Katrina Brandon. She's a senior fellow with the Latin American program of the Nature Conservancy. She's an adjunct professor in sustainable development and conservation biology at the University of Maryland, and she recently wrote a report on ecotourism for the World Bank. Also with us is Craig Shawley. He is the Director of Conservation and Education for International Expeditions. That's an organization that designs and implements eco-tours. So, Katrina, let's start with you. Is ecotourism a way to provide money for local economies that preserve the natural environment, or is it simply greenwashing, a process that trashes the world but makes you feel good about it? And as you respond, very briefly, let us know what you think ecotourism really is.
Well, I think it can do both of those things depending on how it's set up. And one distinction I think that's really important to make early on is the distinction between ecotourism, which I would define as small-scale tourism, versus nature-based tourism, which is tourism that's dependent on nature, but the scale tends to be much grander.
Like the huge ocean liner that...
That is nature-based or nature-dependent. I think we probably need to separate either of those, though, from what we could call sort of sun and surf tourism, or something that's sort of large commercial ocean liners. But large nature-based tourism might be, some examples would be sort of large-scale tours throughout the Annapurna region in Nepal, where you might have hundreds of tourists, or what we see happening at Yellowstone and Yosemite now. That's not exactly an example of sort of a smaller scale, individualized or group tour. And not one is not necessarily better than the other, but I think the issue of scale is very important to keep in mind when we're discussing these.
Okay, and Craig, you organize ecotours, and how do you ensure that these tours are ecologically sound?
Well, I think you have to be very, very careful, and I would agree with Katrina in that ecotourism can be very, very constructive in terms of conservation, but by the same token, if it's not well regulated, it can be very, very destructive, and so you've got to be very, very careful. When we go about designing a tour, we do a great deal of research, and we typically go into an area, and we try to interact with folks that have been working there for a long, long time, folks who've been doing scientific research, if in fact that's available. And then based on sound science, we make contact with local governments and local communities and national governments and try to organize a tour that is sound from a conservation standpoint, supports the conservation effort in the area, and also provides local communities with an opportunity to sustainably make some money out of the deal.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones, and I see we have a call from Paul in Albany, New York.
Yeah.
Paul, you're Talking Green on the Environment Show.
Hi, thank you. It's an interesting discussion. I'm wondering, when Craig talks about doing research and sound science, sometimes that is not the same as dealing with the indigenous population that may have cultural values that may not be based on sound science and research, and yet if they're not respected, it can be very destabilizing.
Good question.
That's an excellent question, and I think it has to be a collaborative approach. I think you have to basically balance your act in terms of how you design a program, and so you utilize sound science, but you also collaboratively develop with local communities and local cultures a program that they are comfortable with. And if, in fact, you don't have their input, obviously the product is not going to be a product that's sustainable.
Katrina, in your work with the World Bank, did you take a look at what this was doing to local indigenous populations?
Well, I have in a variety of different ways, and I would say that there's a range of ways that work can be done to undertake ecotourism with local communities, and it sort of depends who's in charge of the process. And in the kinds of ecotourism initiatives that are out there, you can find everything from ecotourism activities where the local communities themselves have taken total control of the process and that they're using it as a way to safeguard their own lands. There's some examples in South America of that, where they have very clear land title and it is their territories, to others where there's joint partnerships that have been entered into with local communities, in some cases where researchers will be working very closely with local communities for them to undertake the science elements. And then what we find more classically, though, unfortunately, is the case where there's still outside groups that are trying to somehow provide benefits to communities, but those benefits are most likely to be in the form of employment, which is often low-paying and seasonal. So there is a spectrum here, and I think we need to be aware of that.
Paul, thanks for your question. We've got another call. Let's go to Don. Don, you're Talking Green on the Environment Show.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was wondering if there is any way or any set of questions that one as a potential consumer could ask to kind of determine in advance if the tour operator is going to be environmentally responsible.
That's a great question. We all see this stuff out there, see nature, ecotourism, what have you, and yet, as we've heard already, it's a whole different variety of things. Let's hear from you both on that. Craig, how do you tell the good ones from the bad ones in your business?
I think there are a set of questions that you can ask, and certainly you would expect to get the appropriate responses. Katrina mentioned that numbers is a big starting point. When, in fact, you call a tour operator and you talk about a specific tour, I think you need to find out from the get-go what that tour is based on. Is it based on 12? Is it based on 15? Is it based on 20 or 55?
And from your perspective, what's the danger sign? When you hear X, when do you say, hey, this really isn't right?
That depends a great deal upon the area that you're visiting, but I'll be honest with you, the majority of our trips, and we do tours all over the world, Central America, South America, Africa, the Arctic, Antarctic, the majority of our trips are based on about 12 to 15 people. And so you're talking about a relatively small, manageable group of people that can go into an area, and a good operator and a good set of guides can appropriately manage that group under most circumstances.
That would even work in Times Square, New York, I guess.
That probably would work in Times Square, New York, but I wouldn't want to take a group there.
It's a great place.
Well, I would say for consumers that are interested in following up on this, the Ecotourism Society, which is based in North Bennington, Vermont, has something called the Green Evaluation Program, and it's something that consumers can use as a way of asking questions when they're and checking out the quality of a tour while they're on the tour, but it also includes some information before you go on a tour to help you be a little bit aware of the kind of information that might be provided.
And again, what is that group?
It's the Ecotourism Society, and they're in Bennington, Vermont.
And so they presumably could give you a clue as to whether a tour that you were interested in going in really was ecologically okay.
Well, they probably wouldn't tell you about specific operators in particular, but what they could do is they have this green evaluation tool, which you could use as a consumer to be able to ask questions.
So it's a questionnaire that you would ask of the operator
of
as
operators.
To whether they do that.
Right.
Okay. Well, Don, thanks for your question. Let me ask you both a larger issue, and that is that at a time when ecologically fragile areas are under tremendous pressure and disappearing as we speak, does ecotourism really provide the mechanism by which some of these can be preserved? And what are the best examples if it does?
Craig, you want to?
I think there are examples out there. I mean, certainly I hope there are. I think the majority of conservation organizations that we've got in the States and certainly throughout Europe and the rest of the world are heavily considering ecotourism as a strategy. And if used wisely, I believe it can work. There are certainly examples in Central and South America. There are some very, very good examples in Belize wherein local communities have developed programs that are visited regularly by tourists, and in support of their efforts, they have been able to preserve habitat. The same thing is taking place in the Peruvian Amazon. We work there with a nonprofit group called the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research. We actually helped form that group.
And indeed, we've had spokesmen from that group on the Environment Show who
are
doing
that's good.
Great work down there.
They are doing tremendous work, and they've taken an integrated approach to conservation wherein they've got a tourism-based program, they've got a research-based program, they've got a community education-based program. And using the three in tandem with each other, the Peruvian government has been convinced to basically create a 250,000-acre biosphere reserve that before this particular group existed did not exist. And I think that's a classic example of how one can be successful in a region of the world.
Katrina, when you did a report on this for the World Bank, what did you basically conclude when it was over?
Well, I'm known a little bit more as the ecotourism cynic, perhaps. Not that I am cynical against the approach, but I'm cynical against the way that it's been implemented in most places. And up to now, I think it's primarily been a good marketing label. And you find everything from large hotel chains that are now claiming that they're doing ecotourism. What I've been trying to propose is that we are very, very careful in the use of the term to look at it in a way that we can be sure that it'll provide benefits very concretely to protected areas. What I would like to see is a link between ecotourism and some kind of benefit to parks. And that may require a large national policy changes in some countries. For example, there's certain parts of the world where tourists may be paying thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for their trip, but the park may not have any mechanism to even charge entrance fee to those tourists, or they may only be charged $2 to get into a certain protected area when, again, they've paid $5,000 for their trip.
There. So I think do you see any quick way by which the consumer, the person that wants to go on a trip, can sort out the good ones from the bad ones, other than through the checklist that you described?
One way I would encourage them to do it is through some of the major conservation organizations. International Expeditions, I believe, does it work very closely with the Nature Conservancy and in partnership with the Nature Conservancy's Latin American partners, for example. And usually if a company is working very closely with one of the larger environmental organizations, someone's already done that homework for you.
I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking about ecotourism, and my guests have been Katrina Brandon, who is Senior Fellow with the Latin American Program of the Nature Conservancy, and Craig Shelley, who's Director of Conservation and Education for International Expeditions. Let's hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. On a future Talking Green, we'll be speaking about what to do with our stockpile of chemical weapons. Give us a call. The environment is constantly changing. Storms roll through ancient forests and leave marks which last centuries. Mountains are leveled by humans to tap their mineral wealth. The Black Hills of South Dakota have changed dramatically in the past 100 years, and we look at them then and now. In the 1870s, the Black Hills were engulfed in furious Indian wars. Before they were over, General Custer was defeated, and women and children were massacred at Wounded Knee. Then came the boom and busts of gold mining, a cycle which is still evident today. Richard Fort is a resident of Lawrence County, South Dakota. He's known this land all his life and says Lawrence County differs from the dry plains typical in the rest of the state because the Black Hills get more rainfall. He says the area has changed in the past century as people who came here looking to make their fortune.
We had an early history of, I guess I would call, exploiting of the region. With miners and gamblers and all kinds of different types coming in to make their fortune and, of course, get out. And something of that legacy of attitudes toward the area still lingers and is prevalent in the West.
Fort recalls that mining has always been the region's major industry. Mining companies controlled local politics, and many residents owned their livelihoods to it. When he was a boy, Fort says all the mines were below ground. Waste from them polluted the area's streams and killed the fish. Today, most mines are above ground, or strip mines, and Fort says they threaten the region's fastest-growing industry, tourism.
Currently in the West, things have changed from the past. And whereas before, the West was dominated, really, economically by mining, logging, and ranching, actually, those are still here, and nobody would assume that they're going to completely disappear. But the fact is, they are relatively unimportant compared to the new forces. And also, there is the problem that towns that are based on either any of these so-called extractive industries have not flourished. And mining towns tend to be pretty bleak and not very good areas. And yet the West is thriving economically right now. And Lawrence County is doing just fine economically. And the reason for this isn't the historical economic sources, which I just mentioned. The reason for this is the attraction to the area of many other new interests. Of course, there's some industries moving out that just see this as a nice place to settle. And clean water, clean air, beautiful scenery, This is attractive not just to retirees, although that's a big dimension of the changed economy of the West, but also to wealthy people wanting a second home or just to invest, and or to young people just coming and taking their chances. And so there's a change taking place in the West economy. So far, this is not filtered down completely to the political process, because the many of the politicians representing the West are tied to the old interests, you know, the logging, mining, and farming, ranching.
Richard Fort, remembering Lawrence County, South Dakota, then and now. As actor Todd Moore portrayed earlier in the show, logging is seen as a proud profession. Once it was free of the complicated environmental disputes which characterize it today, forests were seen as an endless resource, and felling old-growth timber was viewed as a triumph of the human spirit. Today, many feel we've gone too far. Christopher Shaw is a folk singer from the Adirondack Mountains in New York, which were clear-cut over 100 years ago. From those days came a host of songs celebrating logging. Shaw sings one of them, called Once More a Lumberin' Go.
Come all you sons of freedom who around these mountains range, come all you brave young lumber boys and listen while I sing. By the banks of the sweet Saranac where the limpid waters flow, we'll range the wild woods over and once more a lumberin' go. Once more a lumberin' go, and we'll range the wild woods over, and once more a lumberin' go. To the music of our axes we will make the woods resound, and many a tall and lofty pine comes tumbling to the ground. And at night round our good campfires we'll sing while cold winds blow, and we'll range the wild woods over, and once more a lumberin' go. Once more a lumberin' go, and we'll range the wild woods over, and once more a lumberin' go. You may tell me of your parties and your plays, but pity the poor young lumber boys that jouncing on their sleighs. We ask no better pastime than to hunt the buck and doe, and we'll range the wild woods over, and once more a lumberin' go. Once more a lumberin' go, and we'll range the wild woods over, and once more a lumberin' go. When at last the winter's over and the ice-bound streams run free, we'll drive our logs to Glens Falls and we'll haste the girls to see. With plenty to eat and plenty to drink, contented we will go, and we'll range the wild woods over, and once more a lumberin' go. Once more a lumberin' go, and we'll range the wild woods over, and once more a lumberin' go. When our useful days.
Christopher Shaw singing Once More a Lumberin' Go from his album Adirondack. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 379. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.